Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Wesley Mission Victoria and broadcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Thank you for joining me once again on another program in the award-winning series of Listen to Older Voices. I'm Rob Greaves, and this is the second part of a four-part program in the life and times of baby boomer Pat Wilson. In part one, Pat introduced us to her family, and we gained a good understanding of the support she received from both her parents. Her father, who Pat describes as an intellectual, instilled in Pat the value of education and helped her develop a self-confidence that shines through with everything she undertakes. We begin to understand how Pat developed a love for music, and in this program, we'll flesh this out even more. Pat talks about the explosion of music and music venues in Melbourne in the 1960s. She left school and went to an arts college before gaining a job in the public service. Pat talks about how she came to meet Ross Wilson, one of our most talented and charismatic musicians, singers, songwriters. She marries Ross, and her story includes how they both moved to the United Kingdom. She also includes her thoughts and her feelings on what was then the current Vietnam War, and how, in retrospect, we treated the Vietnam vets badly on their return. Finally, I think you'll find a story of how she and Ross travelled overland, mainly hitchhiking from the United Kingdom back to Australia, absolutely fascinating. In fact, a fascinating conclusion to a fascinating program. But we pick up now with Pat talking about her love for R&B music that was coming out of Motown.
I saw Sam and Dave when I was quite young, and I loved Motown. I thought Motown was just...
Your eyes light up while you're talking about it.
Oh, it's just incredible,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
And such a variety of music. And I mean, they just absolutely spewed out music, you know, probably wrote a song every 10 minutes. And it was just phenomenal. And they had great big, you know, they had brass backing and, you know, and then, of course... You heard James Brown and you know, and see, my mum, like my mother, absolutely loved Otis Redding. See, she loved the Beatles and the Stones too.
Most of them.
So, and then when I met Ross when I was 17, he turned us on to Frank Zappa. So that was pretty wild. We started bringing Frank Zappa home, you know, and Dad was
That tested the parents,
oh, yeah,
it
did. Well, yeah. I think Mum just like, you know, it was like, yeah, right, okay. But Dad came out and he's going, like, what's that? What's going on? You know, and so he had to listen to it and stuff. And then, you know, yeah, he could see the value in the structure of the music.
Very
and
clever.
Yeah,
yes.
And at that stage, my older brother, yeah, he was also into music. And, you know, and he was going out to clubs and stuff with his mates. And then I'd occasionally go with them. Because there was a lot of live music. And then I started going to a blues club called Chicago, which is where I met Chris Stockley and I met Ross. And there were quite a few musos that are around today, a whole lot of people that all went to Chicago. And, yeah, that was a blues club.
Very exciting period.
Absolutely. Music reigned. It really did.
Okay. Let's take another step back then to that period when you are around about 17 and you leave school.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, I went to an art school as well.
Which
then.
One?
I went to Footscray, Footscray Art School. And so, yeah, I was really getting into music big time at that stage. And then when I was 18, I got a job. My dad helped me get a job. I was working in the public service and I stayed there a year. Meanwhile, I met Ross.
At the public service?
Well, I'd seen him before, but he ended up working there, but not in the same place as me.
Now, sorry, I think we should mention, because there are a lot of people listening who are not in our generation.
Yeah.
We are talking about Ross Wilson,
yeah,
who came to be one of our greatest artists.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. How did you actually come to meet him again?
At Chicago.
At the club?
At the blues club.
Right. Was he playing or was he just...
Yeah, he was playing. He was playing harmonica.
Right. Was he in the Pink Finks then or had they moved on for that?
I know. He was in the Pink Finks and I met the guys in the Pink Finks and that was the first time I met Ross Hannaford. And then we ended up being really great friends.
I'd like to talk to you about Ross Hannaford a little later, but come back to Ross W. Was this an instant attraction for you or was it?
Yeah, totally.
Totally.
Yep.
So how did you?
He was very charismatic.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He was for boys and girls.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Incredibly so.
I mean, you know, look, that's what happens.
Mm. How did he respond to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we just.
So it was pretty much a mutual
thing?
Yeah,
it was, definitely, yeah. Right. And, yeah, we became, I mean, we were hard and fast as far as a couple. I mean, we didn't live together.
No, but
we
you were
both,
but
yeah, couple. You know, and he'd come to my place, I'd go to his place. And he was driving at that stage, so that was fantastic. And he lived in Hampton, so it was quite away from Yarraville.
Mm.
And, yeah, first time he drove me home, he got a real shock. He's driving, driving. I mean, seriously, it was 10 minutes from the city, you know, but because he never really – well, his parents used to take him and his brother to Lawn for one set of holidays and Wilson's Prom for the other set. So he was aware of the western suburbs, but he, you know, he didn't really know anybody there.
Yes.
So why would he be there? The Pink Finks finished and then he pulled a band together called The Party Machine and that was a fantastic band and they played a lot of clubs and, yeah, you know, and then, I mean, well, while The Party Machine were going on, there was a band called Procession from New Zealand and they'd won a big comp, which included going to England. So they went off to England and then I don't know how long they'd been in England and they rang Ross and said, look, you know, we need a songwriter and they loved his stuff and could see where he was going. He was starting to write incredibly innovative stuff and he was right out there. You know, he wrote a book and it was banned. And
that's right. He was busted, wasn't he?
Yeah,
the censor police, whatever they
called it. Yeah, the censor police. The illiterate police.
Yeah.
But, oh, yeah, you know, so he was really growing and finding himself. He wrote a huge amount of songs at that stage and he always had a professional outlook on music, totally. And he grew up in quite a musical family.
So for you, you've really transitioned from being a lover of music in the audience to being a lover of music who's actually in a different element of music.
Totally.
You're now involved with the bands and the artists and everything behind the scenes.
Yep.
Was that exciting?
Yeah, very. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Very. And for somebody that, you know, really liked being out there and sort of, you know, discovering new things all the time and going to new places and stuff. I mean, it was perfect for me, you know, and meeting new people and sort of like really stretching out, getting involved in, you know, for instance, I think it was a Thursday or a Friday, there was a guy in the city, I think his name was Mick Kinnear, and he had a really, really famous music shop, which I've forgotten the name of.
I think it was might have been just called Kinnear's.
It may have been.
I remember that shop.
Well, every muso in town that was really interested in music would be there on the days that his shipments would come in, and it'd be, you know, like, I mean, any money that you'd saved up or whatever,
gone.
That was where your money went. Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, you know, you got to know all the other musicians and met some of their girlfriends and, you know, and started to see what gigs were around. And, yeah, exciting times, really exciting times. And everybody, too, was growing and discovering things at the same time as well. So that was pretty interesting.
It wasn't so much that our generation broke the rules as rather sort of ignored them and developed our own rules.
Yeah, exactly.
It was quite a societal change going on.
Oh, huge. Absolutely big time. And overseas, you know, they preceded us by quite a few years as to what they were doing. You know, I mean, England was just going for it big time and, you know, there were you know, like guys like, oh, what was the name of that magazine?
Oh, there was Melody Maker.
They were all happening. No, the Australian guy. Oz. And, of course, that was really starting to blow everything sky high. And, there was Melody Maker and there were a whole lot. They had a whole different lot of DJs and playing all sorts of amazing music because, of course, they were producing a hell of a lot of bands. And at that stage too, same with us. We were really going for it. And, of course, Melbourne was the centre of music.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, everybody that aspired to anything all came to Melbourne to play.
And there were an enormous number of venues then, wasn't there?
Yep.
They were opening them up in old factories,
yep.
in second-story buildings
could find
in the
a
city.
Space. Yep.
Yes.
Yep. It was great.
Concerts,
you know, basements.
Lunchtimes, that's
yep.
right.
Yep, concerts at lunchtime and stuff. And, it was just such an exciting time to be in. And then when Ross went to England, I followed about 3 months later and then we got married over there and, I mean, that was really fascinating.
So approximately what year was this?
69.
Right. So that would have been a very interesting period for you. That
it was
your
fascinating.
First trip out of Australia too, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, it was really, I mean, London at that stage was super wild.
Tell us. Tell
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
Were we talking about in terms of music or
everything? Everything. Everything. It was... the music was amazing and there were clubs everywhere and there were musicians everywhere. And I remember one night the guys were playing in London and Eric Clapton turned up. There was Keith Richard. There were a whole lot of, I mean, they used to just waft in and out of gigs because they wanted to see what was going on as well.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Pat Wilson. And Pat is recollecting the time in the early 70s when she and Ross were living and working in and around London.
Because we lived 25 miles out of London in Surrey, which was just stunning. Lived in this beautiful 26-room house.
That's big.
Oh, it was old and it was just like all those beautiful old mansions you see in the movies. It was just like that. It was on 3.5 acres of beautiful land and we looked after it. That was the deal. We had to look after it, which we did. The girls looked after the inside. The guys looked after the outside.
So hang on. How many people were involved
nine.
In this?
Nine. There were nine of us. And we had a huge music room. And
were all these people involved in some way with Procession?
Yes. That right. included the guys in the band and their wives.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
yeah.
Yes.
And Brian Peacock and his wife had two children. One was only a baby. And the guitarist and his wife had a child, I think, but nobody else did. So we all had to pitch in, you know. And they did a boat trip to America and, you know, and then they played all over London and England and stuff. And it was fantastic. It was just, you know, when you're young and you just breathe it all in. It was just fabulous, you know. And it was also interesting learning the ways of the people that lived directly around us because it was quite a wealthy area.
It's Surrey, yes.
Yeah, you know, and we're in Reigate and, you know, the old fuddies at the local pub sort of getting used to it. They used to call us hippies, which we were just musos. But anybody that was a muso was a hippie.
And everybody was a little bit different. Was
and we were.
Group.
Yeah, yeah totally,
were.
You know.
Absolutely.
And so, they really liked us though. There wasn't anything that they could really complain about because we didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
You know, and I mean, if we had a huge party at our house, who was going to hear it?
Well, that's right. You're so isolated.
No, nobody.
Now, you mentioned this is around about 1969,
yep.
1970,
yep.
and Ross is over there with you in England.
Yep.
It was also the period of the Vietnam War. Does this mean Ross missed out on the...
No, he got called up, but because he had a very bad accident when he was 16, his thigh was smashed to pieces. There was no way he was able
right.
to go. I mean, he had a disability and to this day he still can't squat.
Right.
He's got to keep one leg at a right angle if he kneels down.
Right.
But, yeah, we got involved in protesting about that as well and, you know, my family did and, that was a horrible time.
It was a very tumultuous time, wasn't
really
it?
Horrible.
It
really my father was so against it.
Yes.
Because, you know, having been a young man and seeing the war and being forced to go, which they were too, you know, but I guess the government of the day thought they were being incredibly kind by actually pulling, you know, people's names out of a hat. I mean, oh, duh. Like, what, people were just going to go quietly? I don't think so. And at that stage too, you know, all the young people had a voice of their own. I mean, I was really lucky with my parents, and Ross was incredibly lucky with his parents as well. They were also intellectuals. Not that you had to be an intellectual to be against the Vietnam War, but the thing is, I think that you just happened to tune in more to what was going on politically, let me put it that way, because, I don't think you have to have a high intellect to be opposed to anything, that's for sure. But I think that we were really lucky that our families were the same and just opposed all of that because it was just wrong. I mean, there wasn't any other reason other than it was just wrong and it wasn't our war.
No. Well, I mean, many of us will clearly remember the Prime Minister of the day saying all the way with LBJ.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was the reason, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was disgraceful. Yeah. It was America's war. And, I mean, really, when you look around today, I mean, there's not much has changed.
Not much has changed.
No, Turnbull is still sort of, you know, kowtowing to America instead of standing up and having our own point of view.
Yes.
And, I mean, if that is his point of view, fine, but at the moment it doesn't look like that.
Now, the young men that did go to Vietnam, some went willingly, mm-hmm. some went because the only alternative was jail, and that wasn't palatable.
Mm.
But on their return, they really copped a raw deal.
You're disgusting.
From everybody.
Mm. The way, look, from the way it started, where they were being forced to go, to the way they were treated when they got back was just absolutely disgraceful. And that was one of the things my father was so angry about. And, I mean, my father refused to be part of the RSL. He just thought, I mean, that's another story, but anyway. But, you know, not to be recognised for having post-traumatic shock syndrome and, you know, guys that had horrendous injuries and for people to... I just absolutely was gobsmacked when the first time I ever saw on television someone spitting at a returned soldier. I just could not believe what I was looking at. I just thought, how the hell did it get so screwed up? I mean, what happened? What happened there? You know, how could they have been so badly mistreated? And I think that that's a stain on Australia's history and serves themselves right. No pity at all for people that didn't think twice about what was happening.
Being a person, by your own admission, had been brought up in a family that where politics played an important part along with everything else in your life, how did you see the advent of the Whitlam government?
Oh, like everybody else, it was, you know, was just...
Because that really brought our end of our involvement.
Yeah, and the thing that I felt was that we finally, all those people that had been working all that time towards making things right, were as right as we could at that time in getting rid of the old regime that were just, you know, in my opinion, I thought they were just disgraceful. But, you know... The slogan, it's time. I mean, you couldn't have picked a better slogan. It's exactly what it was. It was time to get rid of everything. I mean, there'd been loads and loads of young people for years. We'd all been moving towards a certain direction, and yet we were still being anchored down by these, you know, people with horrible old thoughts and, you know, refusing to budge and not wanting to let go of the past, and it was just so important to move forward, and we did.
Reminds me of that Bob Dylan line, you know, get out of the way if you can't lend a hand.
That's it. That's exactly it. And my parents, I mean, they would have only been in their 40s at that stage, and, they thought it was just the best thing ever.
Mm.
I mean, there's just nobody that I knew that wasn't overwhelmed that Gough had been elected to power. But it was a no-brainer. I mean, you know, it didn't take anybody long to realise that Gough was just going to sweep it in.
Were you in England when that happened, or had you left England?
No, we'd come back.
So how did that come about? What caused that? Was the work run out, or what was it?
Well, yeah, it sort of did. And I think at that stage too, Ross was probably thinking that he'd like to start doing his own thing as well. And, you know, because, I mean, that line, Russ never sleeps. You know, he had his own ideas of music, and I think that the bare bones of Eagle Rock started there, mm-hmm. or maybe it was when we were living in Darwin, but we virtually hitchhiked from England to Darwin.
You came back overland?
Overland, hitching. Yeah, very dangerous. We sort of realised a couple of times. On an absolute
adventure.
Smell of an oily rag, I can't tell you.
Listen to Older Voices, revisiting through recollections.
Okay, let's not bypass this one too quickly. Was this mostly hitchhiking, or were there trains and buses?
It was mostly hitchhiking.
Goodness.
We did catch buses because there were some places that were just too dangerous for us to hitch. And you've got to remember at that stage the Middle East was just a mess, like it still is. But, I mean, everybody had a gun and, you know, a nice sheath of bullets around them. And even Greece had, I don't think it had been long since the government there had been overturned. And so there was a lot of political unrest in quite a few places. So you had to be really careful. And it was great. Like, Ross was very savvy as to the politics of the countries that we were travelling through. And yeah, so there were places that we caught buses, but it was one of those, you know, we'd have to count out our pennies and work out, yeah, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, and, yeah, we can afford to do that, but we're going to have to catch a walk there and whatever.
Did you have to sleep rough at times?
Yeah, we did. Slept out in fields and, you know, on ice and stuff like that. Goodness. Yeah, we really did.
So what countries did you go through? Can you recall?
We went through France. And then we went to Switzerland, and then we went to Italy and Greece. Yeah. Not in that order.
No.
I'm just trying to remember. Turkey, I found it to be, you know, it was growing, but it was quite, what's the word? You know, there are a lot of areas there that weren't used to seeing travellers.
Right.
And, you know.
So there's still been a reasonably isolated country.
Yeah, they were. I mean, at that stage, though, there were starting to be a lot of people travelling overland. I mean, way before we started. And, you know, the hippie trail, I mean, that was well and truly well trodden. But there were still areas that were quite sort of shocked and mesmerised when you walked into their village. Yeah, we went to Turkey. The Middle East was pretty heavy. The best place in the Middle East for us was Kuwait. We met some lecturers at the university there, and they put us up. They were really, really nice folk.
Coin a phrase, because it's very appropriate. That sounds like it was a real oasis for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. They were great. They were fantastic. And, you know, they took us out and took us to the movies and took us to the uni and stuff like that, and sort of, you know, took us around and showed us a few things. But, yeah, the Middle East was pretty heavy.
Your trip from England to the Middle East, going through most of those European countries, was that a relatively safe period, or was there still dangers in that?
Oh, no, loads of danger. Loads of danger. And I tell you what, it wasn't until we got back and we started swapping a few stories with people that I realised how goddamn lucky we were. I mean, we had an incident in Iraq, in Basra, where a guy locked us in his room, you know, because he told us he was the guy that bought the tickets to go across to, I'm not sure where we were going straight after that. I've forgotten now. Oh, maybe it was to India. He was organising all these tickets and we decided we'd go that route. Well, you know, like after talking to him for a while, we realised it was just crap. It was absolute rubbish. So, look, we made an excuse and we said we had to go to the post office to get the money that our parents had sent us and we'd be straight back and, you know, yeah, of course, duh, made a run for it.
Of course.
But yeah, it was when we got back, I realised how incredibly lucky we were. We did have another incident with a whole lot of guys that were on a truck train coming into Kuwait. And, of course, the border closed at 5 o'clock on the dot, so you just had to wait at the border all night. So we met a couple of really unsavoury people there. But, yeah, you know, look, most times we were pretty lucky. And I think it was because we were travelling as a couple, which really helped.
In part two of her program, Pat finishes off her story of her and Ross journeying back from the United Kingdom to Australia. She talks with great love for her friendship with the late Ross Hannaford and how she recorded Bop Girl, which catapulted her career into the stratosphere. That's next week. Pat Wilson on Listen to Older Voices.